Glad to see all of our visitors with us this morning. Glad everybody's here to worship God, hopefully worship in spirit and in truth. Now, some of you might not realize I'm having a little bit of technical difficulty. So what is on the screen there, I want it to be there, and what's there, I want it to be here, but it's not working out. I'm a little bit afraid to even touch this thing. I think this is an evil plot between Bill Gates and Dell Computers. I've been determined not to buy a new computer for a while. I think I might have been defeated today. But I'm not doing it this week. So this morning, what I wanted to talk to you about was just one word, that word being Numbers. So I'm not going to talk too much about the book of Numbers. I guess actually not talking about the book of Numbers at all. Just numbers in general and how numbers affect us, especially as we come together to worship. So a lot of people, when they think about church, think about congregations, we feel like we need to fill up the building. We have goals of attendance. We want to get this type of membership, these many people to show up, and that's our goal. And sometimes that kind of leaves us empty when we don't achieve that goal. What I want to do is just look a little bit about what God thinks about numbers, in particular, big numbers. So Brother Bob read to us this morning of a scripture that you see a situation where there was the Midianites were going up against God's people. And God wanted them to fight. He determined he was going to send a certain number of people. And he had a little thing that he wanted them to do to determine who was going to go and who was not going to go. So as we read in Judges chapter 7, I'm going to touch this and see what happens. It's kind of doing something. Maybe not. Well, okay, yeah, we're getting there. Okay, so we read in Judges chapter 7 that God had a plan. He was going to attack the Midianites. He was going to have the children of Israel attack the Midianites. And he had several thousand people there. So in verse 3, Gideon talks to his people, talks to God's people, and says, "Go therefore and proclaim to the ears of the people, saying, whosoever is fearful and afraid, let him return and depart early from Mount Gilead, and there return of the people 22,000. So anybody that's afraid, doesn't want to participate, just go home. So 22,000 people left, and there remained 10,000. 10,000 people that remained. So if you have an army and you ask them who's all afraid, you can go home, and over half of them leave, kind of not a very good army, right? So verse 4, "And the Lord said unto Gideon, there are yet too many people. Bring them down to the water, and I will try them. For there it shall be, that of whom I shall say unto thee, this shall go with thee, the same shall go with thee. And whomsoever I say unto thee, this shall not go with thee, shall not go." So he brought the people down to the water, and the Lord said unto Gideon, "Everyone that lappeth of the water tongue like a dog lappeth, him shall thou set by himself, likewise the one that boweth down to drink upon his knees. And the number of them that lappeth putting their hand to their mouth were 300 men, but the rest of the people that bowed their knees to drink water. And the Lord said unto Gideon, by 300 men that lapped, I will save you and deliver the Midianites to thine hand, and out of all the other people go, every man to his place." So 9,000 some odd people knelt down at the water and drank, and there was 300 that scooped the water up in their hands and drank like a dog, lapped like a dog. So when you look at this, what's significant about the way these people are doing that? If we're in a battle situation and I'm trying to sneak up on these guys, who are the ones I could probably pick off easier than those that will be more difficult? The guys that are looking up, attention, right? He's still drinking, but he's looking. All the guys that have bent down there, they're not very, they can't really see that much. So maybe that's why God picked the ones he picked. Maybe they were a little bit better. Maybe they were more prepared. Just the way they handled themselves was going to lend itself better to this battle. So with that, there were 300 people that were left. So all the others are afraid or they didn't drink the water the right way. So God is going to attack these Midianites with 300 men. So we look in verses 16 through 23. See how this battle ensued. And he says, and he divided 300 men into three companies, and he put a trumpet in every man's hand with an empty pitcher and lamps within the pitchers. And he said unto them, look on me, and do ye likewise. And behold, when I come to the outside of the camp, it shall be that, as I do, so shall ye do. And when I blow with the trumpet, I and all that are with me, blow ye the trumpets also on every side of the camp, and say, the sword of the Lord of Gideon. So Gideon, the 300 men that were with him, came to the outside of the camp in the beginning of the middle watch, and they had but newly set the watch. They blew the trumpets and brake the pitchers which were in their hands. And the three companies blew trumpets and brake the pitchers and beheld the lamps in their left hand and the trumpets in their right hands to blow withal. And they cried, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. So basically what happened, he has three groups of 100. They surround the camp. It's dark. It's in the middle of the night. Each man has a trumpet. Each man has a container with the lamp inside of it. So when he says, when I tell you to blow the trumpet, you blow the trumpet, break this pitcher. The lamps are exposed. There's going to be light all around this camp. And the enemy is going to think, what is going on? 300 trumpets, they're all yelling, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. And what ensued was when they did that, the men all got up, all the enemy rose up, and they started attacking each other. So they didn't know what was going on. And they were defeated. So there were thousands of men defeated at the hand of 300. So what does God think about numbers? Is he concerned about filling up pews? I believe he wants the pews to be full. But he wants them to be full with people that are dedicated. It's better to have the 300 than the 22,000, where half of those 22,000 are just afraid, didn't want to do anything. So again, that's the point we're trying to get across. The God looks at numbers. He's concerned about numbers, but I don't think it's in the same way that we get concerned about numbers. Yes, we want to have a full group. We want to pack this building. But we need to have people that are dedicated, that are here with us, that want to be here. So I think that's what God is trying to show. And in this case, he wanted to show his power, that he didn't need a lot of people. And I think, again, the same holds true for us. We have power. We have God with us. So we don't need 10,000 people in this building. We can do what we can do just with the numbers that we have. So that's one example about numbers. Let's look in Genesis chapter 7. Genesis chapter 7. We talked about this somewhat in our Bible class this morning. Genesis chapter 7, and we'll begin in verses 1 through 10. So Noah has built this ark, him and his three sons, and they're about to enter into the ark. And it says in chapter 7 and verse 1, and the Lord said unto Noah, come thou and all thy house into the ark, for I have seen thy righteousness before me in this generation. Of every clean beast thou shalt take to thee by sevens, the male and female, and of the beasts that are not clean by two, male and his female, and of the fowls of the air by seven, the male and the female, to keep seed upon the face of the earth, to keep seed live upon the face of all the earth. Yet for 7 days I will cause it to rain upon the earth, 40 days and 40 nights, and every living substance that I have made I will destroy from the face of the earth. And Noah did according to all that the Lord had commanded him. So I don't know where I saw this. I read somewhere, I think I was on the internet somewhere, that they think that there were as many people on the earth then as there are on the earth right now. How many are on the earth now? 8 billion. So somewhere I read they said they think that there were about 8 billion on the earth then. Don't know how true that is. I'm not sure how they can figure that out. But I know there were more than 20,000 people. There were a lot of people on the earth at the time when this flood occurred. And how many were saved? 8. Again, that's the number that were faithful. That's the number that God has seen had the right attitude and the right disposition of heart. And those were the ones that were saved. So what were the rest of these millions and billions of people doing? God said every thought of their mind was evil continuously. And that happened as Noah built the ark. It happened as it started raining. And I bet you there was some change, though, when the water started getting up to about here on most people, right? That's when they started to realize this is not going well. So again, I don't believe God is interested in numbers per se. He's interested in our hearts, in our attitudes, in our obedience, and not so much our numbers. Let's look in verse 13 in Genesis chapter 7. In the selfsame day entered Noah, Shem, and Ham, and Japheth, and the sons of Noah, Noah's wife, and the three wives of his sons with them into the ark. And verse 21 through 23 says, and all flesh died that moved upon the earth, both fowl and of cattle and of beasts and of every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth, and every man. So there was not a soul that was saved in this flood except those eight. And in all those nostrils was in all whose nostrils was the breath of life, of all that was in the dry land died. And every living substance was destroyed which was upon the face of the earth, both man and cattle and the creeping things and the fowls of the heaven, and they were destroyed from the earth. And Noah only remained alive, and they that were with him in the ark. And the waters prevailed upon the earth 150 days. So I think it's interesting, even when you read this, how it reads. It just doesn't say that all of men was destroyed. It says destroyed. It says that nothing that was breathing was breathing. It was all taken away. So I believe this is showing how devastating this was. This was worldwide. And eight were saved. Is that a big number out of possibly billions? Not a big number at all. So was God interested in numbers per se? Probably not. What about Jesus when he came to earth? How many people did he choose? He could have had thousands of disciples. Thousands of apostles, rather. He had thousands of people that followed, but how many were chosen? That was a short list. Let's look in John chapter 2. John chapter 2. And we'll begin at verse 35. Wait a minute. John chapter 1, I'm sorry. John chapter 1, verse 35, beginning. It says, and again the next day John stood and two of his disciples, and looking upon Jesus as he walked, he said, behold the Lamb of God. And the two disciples heard him speak, and they followed Jesus. And Jesus turned and saw them following, and said unto them, what seek ye? They said unto him, Rabbi, which is interpreted, Master, where dwellest thou? And he said unto them, come and see. And they came and saw where he dwelt, and abode with him that day, for it was about the tenth hour. One of the two which heard John speak and followed him was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. He first findeth Simon, and said unto him, we have found the Messiah, which is being interpreted, the Christ. And he brought him to Jesus. And when Jesus beheld him, he said, thou art Simon, the son of Jonah. Thou shalt be called Cephas, which is by interpretation, a stone. So is anything interesting in this little introduction here? Do we see where anybody told Jesus what this man's name was? He just seemed to know. Verse 43, in the day following, Jesus would go forth to Galilee and findeth Philip and said unto him, follow me. Now Philip was a Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip findeth Nathanael and said unto him, we have found him of whom Moses in the law and the prophets did write, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. And Nathanael said unto him, Can there any good thing come out of Nazareth? And Philip said unto him, come and see. So kind of something you hear today. Hey, we found the Christ. He's in Louisville. And what would people here say? Can anything good come out of Kentucky? So that's kind of the thing. It was kind of what they call throwing shade. It was not a compliment. What are you talking about out of Nazareth? That's just a little bitty old town. What good comes out of that? And Philip said, just come and see. Jesus saw Nathanael coming to him and said unto him, behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom is no guile. Nathanael said unto him, whence knowest thou me? So again, he's still kind of giving it to him, right? Well, how do you know me? Jesus answered and said unto him, before that Philip called thee, when thou wast under the fig tree, I saw thee. So even as he didn't see Nathaniel, he didn't see anything that Nathaniel thought he saw, but he said, anything good out of Nazareth? And how do you know me? I saw you under the fig tree. And again, kind of a miracle. Nathaniel answered and said unto him, Rabbi, thou art the Son of God, thou art the King of Israel. And Jesus answered and said unto him, because I said unto thee, I saw thee under the fig tree, believest thou? Thou shalt see greater things than these. And he said unto him, verily, verily, I say unto you, hereafter ye shall see heaven open, and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. So even as Jesus is gathering his disciples, his apostles together, he's showing them some things. Just the fact that he didn't get any names, but he's knowing their names. He's seeing what where they are and what they're doing. And even as they're kind of being a little bit resistant, a little reluctant, he's choosing these men. But he's not choosing droves. He's not choosing 300. He didn't ask people to drink water to choose 300. He chose 12. Let's look in Matthew chapter 17. Matthew chapter 17. So we see even with him choosing those 12, some of them were closer to him than others. Matthew chapter 17, and we'll begin at verse 1. It says, After six days, Jesus taketh Peter, James, and John, his brother, and bringeth them up into a high mountain apart. So he's only taken three of his 12. He's taken three that are close and took them up to a mountain. And he was transfigured before them, and his face did shine as the sun, and his raiment was white as the light. And behold, there appeared unto him Moses and Elijah talking with him. Then answered Peter and said unto Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If thou wilt let us make us here three tabernacles, one for thee, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. And while he yet spoke, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and behold, a voice out of the cloud which said, This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased, hear ye him. And when the disciples heard it, they fell on their face and were sore afraid. And Jesus came and touched them and said, Arise and be not afraid. And when they had lifted up their eyes, they saw no man save Jesus only. So again, the point here is even as Jesus had his 12, there were some that were closer than others. There were three that were really close to him. And we've talked a little bit, we're studying the book of Peter. We talked about Peter being impetuous, Peter being the one that is going to say something. So we see Peter. Great for us to be here. Let's build three tabernacles. And probably as soon as that, pow. Hear my son, whom I'm pleased. They bow down and look up, and only Jesus is left. So only three were privileged to see that event. So was God interested in numbers? I would say not necessarily. He's looking for those that have the right heart, that have the right drive, the right motivation, those that are obedient. That's what he's looking for. He's not looking for numbers. Because I'll tell you this, where are the numbers this morning? I'm sure there are congregations, churches that are just jam-packed, full. And after they say their last amen, what are they going to do? Go down the fellowship hall, have something to eat, and be drinking and frying chicken and eating green beans and all kinds of good stuff. So why are they really there? Is it to hear the gospel or is it to have some good chicken? So God does not want the numbers. If we did the right things as far as man is concerned, we could fill this building up three or four times over. Have car show, I'd be in charge of that probably. All kinds of stuff, right? But that's not what God wants. He wants our heart. He doesn't want numbers. Because we see in Matthew chapter 7, Jesus talks a little bit about those numbers. Matthew 7, verse 13 and 14, it says, Enter ye at the straight gate, for wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leadeth to destruction, and many be there which go in thereat. Because straight is the gate, and narrow is the way which leadeth unto life, and few be there that find it. So the way to Christ is straight and narrow. So there are, in Louisville, two main bridges that go across three bridges. They built a fourth. But there's also a train bridge that goes across. And this train bridge, there's a train in the middle on either side. Cars used to be able to go across. And where the cars were, it seemed like that bridge was about that wide. And the bridge was made out of iron. So when it rained, it was real slippery. And I can remember us going on that bridge a few times, and it just, and we're sitting in the back seat. Daddy's driving, like, things bounce this way, hit the train, and bounce that way, you're into the water. So it was just kind of scary for us, for me, just because it was a skinny bridge. And they had a little turnouts. I think there were about two of them. You could pull your car over, and if somebody needed to do something, there were little turnouts. But when I think about straight and narrow, I think about that bridge. That's a hard bridge to deal with because there's no messing around. You can't mess with your cell phone and do all the kind of stuff we do now when we drive. And the smart cars that can drive themselves, I'm not sure if they could really deal with that bridge. So when I think straight and narrow, that's what I'm thinking. There's just no room for error. There's just no way to really navigate without being true and going straight. So Jesus is telling me that the road to heaven, straight and narrow, there's not going to be a lot. But broad is the other way. You know, you can just whiz around, just do all kinds of good stuff on all these major highways, and you know, that's easy to navigate those. I can make a mistake and, you know, go off the road. I won't even get close to the guardrail, right? Because it's broad. There's a lot of people going through there, and they're going fast. But the straight and narrow is more difficult to navigate. So Jesus is telling us that, even as he was on earth. Again, Numbers, Matthew 18, verse 20. Matthew 18 and verse 20 talks about what he's looking for. It says, "For where there are two or three gathered together in my name, there I am in the midst of them." So when there's two or three that are gathered in his name, he's with them. If there are 2,000 or 3,000 that are gathered and they're not in his name, they're not going there for the purpose of being for God. I guess you could say the inverse is true. He's not going to be there. He's not going to be with them if they don't have their heart and soul set. So again, to me, this is telling us he's not looking for the masses. He's looking for those that are dedicated, those that are together for his name. So, I'm going to tell you a little story. A few years ago, I went to Pennsylvania for work. We were in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. And we decided the meeting was over a little bit early, so we said, hey, let's go to, we went to Hershey, Pennsylvania one night. We got to smell all the chocolate in the air. Another day we went to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. So that's where the Gettysburg battle occurred. So I'm asking one of the ladies, she's at this tourist shop. I said, Miss, we're here, we're visiting. We want to get to the battlefield. Can you show us where it is and tell us about it? She says, well, you know, pretty much the whole city is a battlefield. Lady, I know I'm from out of town. Just tell me where it is. So I don't know what expression I gave her, but she said, well, yeah, the whole city's a battlefield. You get to choose. There's different companies that take tours. So we went to the national site. There was a big bus thing. It was all air-conditioned. They could probably see 75, 80 people. We went to this other place. They offer tours. This place was probably smaller than this auditorium. It was kind of musty, and the lights were dim, and it was just old. In the corner, it looked like they had a whole bunch of long pieces of paper that were wrapped up in tubes, and they had all these tubes stuck everywhere. So I was with a couple of guys. They were Navy SEALs, prior Navy SEALs. So we were joking around, saying, oh, those are probably battle plans from the Revolutionary War. We kind of laughed and chuckled. And so the guy says, you know, we got a pretty good rate. So we decided we'll take these guys, the cheap guys, over the big bus. So we got on the little bus. It's a 1937 Ford. We got on there, and the guy says, well, there's an audio thing that we'll play. There's a CD, but we got to get it working, so just bear with us. Technical difficulties of this. So he pulled the floor out of the bus, and he was digging around with wires and the speaker this, and that ain't working. And he says, well, I don't think we're going to get that thing working, so we'll just drive, and I'll talk to you. And the tour was excellent. I thought it was just fantastic. So I was so excited, I got my kids and family to go to Gettysburg a couple of years later. Went to the same place, same battle plans in the corner, lights were still dim, but they had a newer bus. So this might be all right. So we got on the bus. I don't think there was a microphone thing working, but there was an air conditioner in the back, and it was vibrating, making noise, and no cool air was coming out, so I think they were mad at me. What are you doing? Why do you make us do these silly things? Anyway, the bus took us around the battlefield. The battlefield was pretty much the entire city. And there were all these monuments all through. I mean, there were hundreds of these monuments. And you can kind of tell on some of the monuments who they're dedicated to. It'll have writing at the bottom talking about the unit, the state they came from. This was a field artillery unit that's being represented there. So I was, for the second time, very impressed when we went to Gettysburg to see these places that these battles occurred. So an interesting thing about field artillery, I was with the field artillery unit here in Bloomington for about 8 years. So I know a little bit, about that much, about field artillery. Field artillery then is a lot different than field artillery now, but some of the things have remained the same. So in those units, you might not be able to read this, but basically there are 8 guys on each gun, and there are 4 other guys that are helping them operate that gun. So there are 12 people per gun. And that's another picture of a gun. So they've got horses. Horses are pulling boxes, carrying ammo. They've got bags of black powder that they're dealing with. So I want to try to you how these guns operate, and it's not easy. So this was in Kentucky. These are some guys that were doing some reenactment. So there's several guys there. So when you have that gun's going, you've got the end of it's called the muzzle, breech. So that's where you light things off, and the bullet comes out the other end of the muzzle. So to get the gun going, you have to put the black powder in the muzzle. Take this long Q-tip thing, push that powder in good. Take the ball, put the ball in there. Take the Q-tip thing and push that all in good. Then another guy comes at the back of the breech, and he has to use some flint, just making sparks. When he gets a spark enough, they've got a wad of paper. When that gets lit, it burns down, and boom, the bullet goes out. So to fire the next round, I can't just put more powder in there because there might be some embers burning at the end of this thing. So if I put the powder and there's stuff still burning and I stuck my Q-tip and start going, it might boom, blow. There goes my Q-tip and there goes me. And it's not a good day. So you have to put some water in there, kind of get everything a little wet. And once you're sure there's nothing burning, more powder, Q-tip, another ball, Q-tip, got lights. I mean, it's all just everybody has a place to do, a thing to do. And everybody knows they're just that quick. So there's a reason for me telling you about all that. 8 guys, 4 guys there helping. And their job is just to send off as many as they can. Boom. Boom. And I just want that constant boom. The captain comes over. I need you guys to point the gun this way. They'll move around. Go. Boom. And they just need to keep boom. And it's probably 3 or 4 minutes before each time they shoot. So it's not easy. You see what they're wearing? They're all wearing the different hats. The field artillery guys had red stripes on their legs. So they used to call those guys red legs. So if I'm out fighting and there's all the smoke and everything, and I see a guy with the red stripe, I know he's a field artilleryman. If I need him on this side of the battle, I can grab him, take him over there. So that's how this is supposed to go, by the numbers, in order. So in this picture, there's a young kid. He looks like he's about 12. That's probably real. You'd have young kids that were there, one of the 4 that are helping, probably some kids, while the rest of the older guys are doing their thing. And you see the Q-tip. You can't really make it out. There's a Q-tip right there. So that thing's a big, long thing, and they shove that in there just to make all that work. So in this particular time in Kentucky, they let us do this. They let us fool around with some of this. And I even got to wear the guy's hat. I said, all right, when you wear the hat, you're in the command. So, you know, they had different people that just there visiting. So I'm giving the commands. Okay, say this. Ready for battle. So they do their thing and load one ball. And they're looking at me like, hey, were you in the army or something? Yeah, I used to be a captain. Oh, okay, that makes sense. Sound like you know what you're doing. So I really did not. But I got to wear the hat, and we went through all those drills, and it was one thing after another. It was quite a bit of fun. So it was a little bit of sophistication back then. You wouldn't think so, but it was sophisticated. So this is one of the big balls, big musket ball. They've got another thing that looks like a regular bullet that we would see now, but there's stuff in another ball there that's got stuff inside of it. So that technology was to the point where when those balls shot out, they could time it to where they exploded in air, and all these other pieces fell out of it, which caused people to fall down, right? So the technology was getting pretty good. So it was a difficult thing in these battles. So just remember that there's 8 guys working the gun, 4 assisting. So there's 12 per gun. Okay? And what they're wearing, the Battle of Gettysburg happened in July 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. So it wasn't cold, it was very hot. Then you look at these guys' uniform, they're all made out of the scratchy, itchy wool, and they had gloves, and they had the hat, and they had a jacket, and they wore a shirt and tie. It just, that's what you wore. All your buttons were brass. I mean, they had to shine buttons up and all that. So it was not an easy thing to be in that situation. So this is a guy kind of explaining to us what it's like to be in that battle. So here's the scenario. Just picture yourself, you're one of 12 in this battle. And you're doing your due diligence. You've got the guy that's doing the Q-tip, waits, somebody puts the ball in, he's doing the Q-tip, he stands, another guy flinches, boom, ball goes out. Put the water in there, douse that. Got another thing of powder, put that in, Q-tip, another ball, powder, light, boom. And we're doing good until the enemy shoots back at us. And now there's something, we hear a boom, but it's on the bad end of the boom. We hear the boom, and 8 of us fall down. So there's 4 left. And it's not necessarily the 4 that are just helping. There might be 4 of those 8 that really know what they're doing. There might be 2 of those guys left. And now I need these helpers to do things. So what do? We don't have 4 guys, maybe 2 of them that don't know what they're doing. One guy, when they went boom, he can't even hear now. He's just deaf. There's just a ringing. So I'm trying to talk to him and say, hey, put the water in before you put the... Think about that, how tough that is. So do we get to just say, hey, Captain, our gun's done. We're only 4 of us left. Used to be 12. Do we have that option? Nope. So remember that little kid we saw earlier? This guy? I might have to recruit him now. Hey, Billy, I need you to go get some more of these balls. These things are heavy, 24 pounds, 12 pounds, 6 pounds. So if we're shooting 24-pounders, I need Billy to come up with this. Billy's only 12. Billy, I need you to put that ball in there. But they're shooting at us. I mean, things are coming at us. It's smoke. I read about these, they had horses that were pulling these things. So horses are not dumb. When they hear the booms and people falling out and screaming, the horses don't want to be there. Really. So I've got to have somebody just keeping the horses back. Come on, Sally, be still. Oh, come on, Sally. The thing I read also said it's even worse with mules. Wow. Because mules... they're not really going to, they're buck and kick, but the mule's just going to lay down. He just can fall out. So now I'm trying to get the mule up because he's rolled over. And I know it sounds comical, but, I mean, when these things are happening and the bullets are coming at you, this is a bad situation. And what happens when you have a war? People die. So when you start off with those 12 guys, eventually it's going to get down to 10. An hour or two later is 9 of us. An hour or two later is 5 of us. And that's what it's like. That's what happens. And each of these guns are still, they need these guns to keep firing. So again, remember that. This war's going on, we're losing people. And I've got to recruit little guys things. I've got to figure out a way to make the horse stop running and running off into the field. And if the horse is gone or he's got the rest of our ammo, have any balls left to put in these guns. What do I do? So, the thing that was most interesting to me was we were at Big Round Top. So this was a really big hill. And it wasn't too bad for us because we were on the bus with no air. So we made it up fairly easily. We got there, there's all these monuments. So there's a boy right there about that tall. And I'm standing on another higher part of the hill, quite a distance away from him, really trying to get this tower, but there's that kid. So the place was big. It was just a lot of room. It was spread out, and there were monuments all over this hill. That's what it looks like at the top of Big Round Top. So if you see at the top, that's more the city of Gettysburg. So when I'm on this hill, you can see out, way out. So when you have 9,000-10,000 guys walking across a field toward you, trying to come up that hill to get you, you can hear them, you can see them. I mean, we're yelling back and forth, "You guys need to stay down at the bottom of the hill." They're yelling, "We're coming up to get you guys." Right, so it's not just, you know, you watch the some of the reenactments, everything's quiet, and there's somebody talking, "Well, these guys are coming to come this way," and it wasn't quiet, it was loud. It was a lot of confusion going on. So the story goes, as these guys, as the Confederate Army was advancing up this hill, they were hiding out in these rocks. There was a bunch of rocks. These are cars. There's three or four cars right there. These are some big rocks. So these guys can sneak up behind the rocks. They're probably far enough away I really can't shoot them, but they can start shooting a little bit at me, and they can hide, right? So the story goes, that battle went on all day. The Confederates marched up that hill. They were shooting. We were, you know, cannons going back and forth. Confederates said, "Hey, we got to fall back. We can't do it." So they regrouped. "Well, let's get ammunition off this person. Let's do this and go back up. You guys, instead of going up the middle, you guys go inside, and you guys go around this way." They charged again. Second time, they failed. They came back down. But what's happening? Again, back to our scenario. There are certain guns where we had 12. Now we have 10. After the second advance, now we have 9. Now we have 6. Confederates came up a third time. Each side is losing people each time this is going on. So I believe about the fourth time, the Confederates got up the hill. They had spent their energies gone. They don't have any ammunition left. They get up there the fourth time, and they just surrender. We're done. Wave the white flag. We're done. We don't have anything else. So the Union Army's kind of, they're celebrating. And they were actually all out of ammo. They had no more bullets. And they had, as a matter of fact, fixed bayonets, because that's the last resort. If I can't shoot them, I can run at them and stick them. They had fixed their bayonets. Confederates, they surrendered. They marched those guys off the hill. And supposedly, one of the privates told one of the lieutenants, "Hey, sir, I'm all out of ammo." Lieutenant was, the Confederates didn't know that. They did not know that the Union Army had used up all its ammunition. They were so beat down and tired, they just gave up. If they kept pressing on with whatever they had, they probably could have taken that hill. So what's the point of that? We are in a spiritual battle. And we're seeing people fall left and right. We might have 20 people. We might have 15. We might be down to 8. But we have to keep going. You have to keep those guns going. You have to enlist people that some things they had never done before. We're in that situation now. I never led a song before. Okay, I'll give it a try. I've never preached before. Okay, I'm going to give it a try. That's where we are. So we can't give up. Got to keep fighting that battle. Because in Romans chapter 8, it tells us a few short words that would hopefully sustain us. Romans 8:29 says, let's go to verse 28. And we know that all things work together for the good of them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose. For whom did he foreknow, he also did predestine to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. Moreover, whom he did predestinate, them he also called, and called them he also justified, and whom he justified, he also glorified. What then shall we say to these things? If God be for us, who can be against us? And I guess the answer to that, everybody could be against us. But who's going to win? Who's going to prevail? Those that are on the side of God. Those of us that are trying to do what God would have us to do, we are going to be the ones that prevail. Not those others. I guess everybody's nervous. Elections in a couple weeks. And we're all saying, no matter who wins that, we're sunk. How can we get these the two worst possible people in the world? How do we get to this? What are we going to do? Woe is us. To me, we're in that battle. Our 12 men, we're down to about three. But what are we going to do? Those three have to fight on. Despite who's the president, despite who gets on the Supreme Court, we still have a job to do to make sure we're holding that banner for Christ. So I'm a little frustrated with the election, but it's not, I'm not going to stop coming to church. I'm still going to be coming to church, still going to be leading songs, doing what I'm doing. That's what we need to do. That's the only way that we're going to make this better. So if God is with us, who can be against us? And finally, let's look in 2 Timothy. 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 1 through 8. And it says, "Our charge thee before God and the Lord Jesus Christ, who shall judge the quick and the dead at his appearing in his kingdom. Preach the word, be instant in season, out of season, reprove, rebuke, exhort with all longsuffering and doctrine. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but after their own lust they shall heap unto themselves teachers having itching ears. And they shall turn away their ears from the truth, and shall be turned unto fables. But watch thou in all things, endure afflictions, do the work of an evangelist, make full proof of the ministry." Now, where in there did God say in Timothy, by the way, when you get 200 people together, move out. When you get 30 people together, go ahead and do it. He said that to Timothy and Timothy alone. Preach the word. Be instant, in season. Verse 5 again, "But watch thou in all things." Not watch all you guys, but he's telling Timothy alone. "But watch thou in all things, endure afflictions, do the work of an evangelist, make full proof of thy ministry." So there's no waiting for the backup. The cavalry's not coming. The cavalry's God. So just like Timothy, we need to take those instructions and just move out and do what is set before us to do. So hopefully that was encouraging. I know we get our numbers are low. We kind of talk amongst ourselves. And, you know, I think the worst thing we can do is talk about who used to sit where. They're not here. And I'm not saying that in a mean way. They're not here. And some are doing great things. Maybe some are not doing so great things. We need to figure out and concentrate on who is here. Who's sitting right there? Who's over here? Who's able to do what? And work together. Because we're all we have. Our guns, 12 people, we're down to 3. Got to keep fighting. So that's the lesson for this morning. For those that have not become members of the body of Christ, today is a good opportunity to do that. It is, we're not promised today. We're not promised the next minute. We have what time we have, and that is it. So if there are those that are subject that need to become a member of the body of Christ, you have an opportunity to do that. If there are others that need to ask for prayers and forgiveness of whatever, or just for strengthening, you have that opportunity. And you might think those of us that stand behind this podium, we're good to go, we're the strong ones, we've got it licked, and we don't need any help. That's false. Couldn't be anything more wrong. We struggle just as much as everybody else. So if anybody has any need at this moment, and you feel like you want to come forward, you have that opportunity as we together stand and sing page 935.